And our very special guest tonight, Ken Gerhardt. We're talking about his work in the field of cryptozoology. And we'll be back with Ken. Many more stories on Coast to Coast AM. Ken, there have been some stories about Bigfoot samples, DNA, but they really never really panned out. What's going on in that arena?
Well, that's true. I mean, there have been, to my understanding, some discussions on forums lately that someone is in possession of Bigfoot DNA. I'm, of course, eagerly waiting to see how it does pan out. I think that obviously would be fairly huge, but you know, we also have to consider the ambiguity of that type of evidence. I mean, at this point, as remarkable a notion as Bigfoot seems to be, and as hard as it would be for the populace to digest that concept, would it take something more substantial, like an actual body? I'm wondering, or people accept DNA evidence? Depending on the source.
If the only way to capture Bigfoot was to shoot it, what would you say about that?
Wow, yeah, that's a pretty hot topic within the field of Bigfoot research, obviously. And,
I say let it go.
Certainly a grisly notion, to be sure. It is worth noting that many of the pioneers of Bigfoot research that are very highly regarded, such as John Green and Grover Krantz, others have, Rene DeHinden, have come out and stated that they thought that that's what it would take, that it would take an actual body to convince scientists. And,
wow.
And in fact, Dr. Grover Krantz remarked that, just to have the body wouldn't be enough, that you would actually have to take it around to different scientists and rub their noses in it.
Right. So they'd have to poke and prod it.
Yeah, so, I mean, that has been the protocol, for classification of a new animal species as a type specimen.
It's like King Kong all over again, isn't it?
Yeah, it's very sad.
I would say let it go, but I don't think that's going to happen. I think somebody would take a shot at it somewhere.
Yeah, more than likely. I mean, it's, of course, the best case scenario would be that someone would perhaps come upon a body of a creature that had died of natural causes.
That's different. Absolutely. Let's talk a little bit more about Bigfoot. I mean, chupacabras and your expedition. You were just down in Texas. Let's talk a little bit more about that.
Yes. Well, and again, the name chupacabra has probably been a little bit romanticized, by the media and so forth, at least as far as these animals in Texas go. In fact, many of us in the field of cryptozoology are starting to refer to these Texas version as blue dogs. We know that they're canids. We know from many DNA tests that have been done that they are either coyotes or hybrids with coyotes and wolves and domestic dogs and so forth. The real mystery again is their appearance, which that seems to be becoming a little bit more clear now.
And describe that, if you would.
Describe their their appearance?
Yeah.
Well, they are typically, weigh anywhere from 20 to 40 pounds. They look very canid in appearance. However, their skin is completely hairless, and the skin also seems to have a strange bluish-gray coloration. In addition to that, these animals have displayed several other abnormalities, including very bizarre teeth or dentition, very long fangs or canine teeth. Long claws. In some cases, the animals have had disproportionate limbs, for example, the forelimbs being much shorter than the hind limbs. In some cases, the animals have had, what you would call skin flaps on their hindquarters. And this is one of the more startling pieces of the mystery. If these animals are simply hairless coyotes, why do they have these strange flaps or pouches on their hindquarters? We've seen this in a couple of animals so far.
It's almost like kangaroos, but on their hips, huh?
Yes, absolutely. Now, the notion of chupacabra, and of course, the name chupacabra is derived from goat sucker, because it is believed that these animals do drink the blood of small farm animals.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we really don't have any scientific proof of that. We do have allegations that they've come into chicken coops, for example, and killed chickens, but you know, with a single bite and then lapped up their blood. You know, again, there's nothing really scientifically conclusive behind that. I don't believe they have the adaptations needed to actually drink blood.
These creatures in Texas, why are they, when they're found, aren't many of them found dead?
Well, that's true. Many have been found dead. Many have, in fact, been shot, you know, which I know is very sad, but, you know, I think it's a testament to the fact that they look so unusual. You know, I think they've actually frightened some people quite badly because, you know, their appearance is quite hideous.
Yeah.
You know, some have been road killed. In fact, a great number have been road killed.
There must be a lot of them, Ken.
Yeah, there really are. And I don't think, you know, people are aware of how many of these things are running around out there right now. They seem to be proliferating. They seem to be adapting to their environment well, whatever they are. I'm personally aware of several dozen reports, encounters, and photographs, and I've examined the remains of at least five of these animals myself. So there are a startling number of them out there now, and they seem to be spreading out of Texas. I'm receiving more and more reports from states like Oklahoma and Mississippi and so forth.
Do they all seem to look alike?
They are very similar. There have been some slight variations. For example, the animals with the skin flaps that I mentioned seem to be males, so it could be a case where we have what we call sexual dimorphism, where the males and females look a little bit different.
Okay.
The two animals that were found near Cuero, Texas, and of course there's a famous lady down here who actually had one stuffed and mounted, those animals are much larger than we would say compared to a Texas coyote. Texas coyotes are actually very small. They only get to be about maybe 15 or 20 pounds. And several of these animals have been much larger, weighing up to 40 pounds. So they're much larger than say, coyotes. So that's a bit of a mystery as well.
How close do they match the description of the so-called chupacabra in Puerto Rico?
Well, they're, you know, very different, of course, but there are more similarities than people realize. For example, both versions are reported to have a gray color, very sharp teeth and claws, and resemble a kangaroo in some respects.
And smaller forearms, right?
Yes, exactly. And the real similarity lies in how they are alleged to kill their prey by drinking the blood in a vampire-like manner. But, of course, the Puerto Rican version does seem to be something entirely different. You know, the way it's been described as having very large, red, almost insect-like eyes, and also a row of spines or spikes running down the length of its back, and also walking bipedally.
These Southwest creatures here, have they been known to attack people or animals?
There was, in fact, one woman who was bitten last year. And it was actually a strange case where this animal had somehow entered into a camper on her property. And when she went inside, she initially thought it was a sickly dog and tried to give it some water or food. And that's when it lunged out and bit her. Subsequently, the woman was taken to a hospital and, of course, received a series of shots.
Rabies shots, yeah.
Yeah, and the animal was unfortunately killed. That's the only attack that I'm aware of, you know, but again, there have been many allegations that they've killed a number of farm animals.
Let's take some time for a moment and talk about the Mothman. Mythical creature, or what did they see?
Wow. Well, you know, Mothman is one of the most enigmatic and notorious figures in the annals of the unexplained, I think. I mean, you have this winged man-like creature that stands as tall as a man with enormous bat-like wings attached to its back and completely headless with these two giant red eyes set in his shoulder.
Yeah.
So, excuse me. It definitely doesn't resemble anything we know of in the natural world. In terms of its behavior, highly unusual as well, alleged to chase vehicles and so forth. So I definitely think that we're dealing with something very unnatural.
Well, whatever this thing could be, who knows? You know, a lot of people, if you tie in the Thunderbirds with the Mothman sightings, maybe it's a big bird that they see on the side of the road. You there?
Yeah, I think, in fact, that that's one of the primary reasons why Mothman is investigated in the field of cryptozoology. You do have these reports of giant bird-like creatures. There seem to be a high concentration of them in the states of West Virginia, Ohio, and Pennsylvania, which is the general area where people have encountered the Mothman. So, in fact, there is a theory that, in fact, people were encountering these giant thunderbirds and interpreting it as being something entirely different. So that's at least one explanation that I think is, quite possibly valid.
Yeah, I mean, there's something there, and there's something very large that people have noticed. Are we still getting, Ken, Mothman sighting reports, or has that faded away?
Well, there was a sort of a wave of Mothman-type reports that came out of Mexico back in 2009. The descriptions were somewhat similar, basically a humanoid-type figure with enormous wings. The behavior was quite similar as well. In fact, the creature was alleged to have chased several vehicles, which is...
That's gutsy.
So, in that respect, I would say that similar types of beings have been reported. But
you want to go get yourself a little glass of water?
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm getting a little bit parched here, but let me get a drink and come right back.
Come right back, because I'm here all by myself. So you go get your drink, and I will continue chatting for a little bit. Hey, that happens sometimes. See, I have the luxury of a cough button here, so you can't hear that when I have to choke or cough or something. I get to hit my little button. Which I have in the cave in St. Louis, and I have here in Los Angeles. I've got one in our Hawaiian studio, which I've got to try out, too. Have you returned, Kenneth?
Yes, I have.
Very
good.
George. Did that help you out?
Yeah, I think part of the problem is that I was actually out in that Chupacabra expedition this weekend. It was very, very dusty and dry. We were out in the plains of Texas.
Uh-huh.
And
I think
We all came back with sort of a sore throat and a little bit of an allergic reaction to that. I apologize.
A lot of allergies out there. No, that's okay. You just have a little water by your side, as I always do every night, and off we go with this. But these creatures, especially the Mothman creature and John Keel's work on this, they seem to be tied to, is it the Jersey Devil or Mothman that's tied to catastrophes?
Well, it's certainly a belief by many of the locals in Point Pleasant, West Virginia, that Mothman was somehow associated or linked to the collapse of the Silver Bridge, which was a great tragedy that happened about that same time period. Also, looking back into different legends of anthropomorphic winged man-like creatures in history, we find that there is often this belief that they were, in fact, omens of destruction, harbingers of doom, and so forth. So certainly there is that belief. And there's also a belief that there's a curse associated with Mothman, that many of the people that have investigated Mothman, like John Keel, actually, mm-hmm. Dealt with it, many unexplained things afterwards.
Lots of strange creatures out there. And, of course, Wolfman and Werewolf, that's another set of creatures. Now, it's not just mythological, is it?
Well, werewolves, of course, are some of the creatures that don't fit neatly into the scope of cryptozoology. We tend to file them into personally I refer to them as fringe creatures. Much like Mothman, they really do not have a sound basis in zoology, although they do have certain animalistic aspects. For example, werewolves have been described as looking very much like real wolves, but much larger.
Right.
Much shaggier, more ferocious, and so forth. So, looking at the fossil history, we actually do have different types of fossil canids. For example, the dire wolves that lived during the Ice Age. There were enormous carnivorous beasts in the Paleocene, for example, the amphicyonids. That very much resembled what people would describe as looking like a werewolf, or essentially a giant, ferocious superwolf. So I think, if we think of it in those terms, that there certainly could be a possibility that there could be something running around out there that very much resembles what we would think of as a werewolf. but perhaps not a werewolf in the traditional sense.
How did the ancients get these incredible stories of man turning into wolf? You had to kill him with a silver bullet. You had to do things like that. How did that all happen?
Well, it seems to be a very cross-cultural belief as far as shapeshifters. I mean, this is something that we find. It's very prevalent in North American mythology. Looking around the world at different other legends and mythologies, we have different types of man-beasts. For example, in Africa, there are were-hyenas and were-lions. As far as my research into werewolves, I haven't really found any indication that that's, in fact, what people are describing. For example, with the Beast of Gévaudan, which was a very famous werewolf case that took place during the 18th century.
That sounds like in France.
Yes, it was in the south of France.
Ah, perfect.
And what's interesting about that particular case is that there actually were victims. In fact, there were probably about 60 to 100 people whose deaths were attributed to the Beast of Gévaudan.
Oh, jeez.
So,
That's a lot of people.
Yeah, exactly. So, but what people were describing was similar to a wolf, but much larger. Ultimately, there were many theories about what that creature could have been. And in fact, an animal was shot about the time the killing stopped. And so, there's a good chance that, in fact, the beast was shot. I did an investigation several years ago, and we turned up some evidence that, in fact, what people may have been dealing with was an escaped hyena.
A big one.
Yes, and hyenas, of course, are very vicious and look...
They look scrungy, don't they?
They look scrungy, and they look similar to wolves, particularly to people that aren't familiar with them. Although they're very different in other ways.
Have you investigated vampires? Would you put vampires in cryptozoology or not?
Definitely not.
Definitely.
I think vampires are they're a little uncomfortable for most cryptozoologists.
Yeah, I think so too.
The closest we've come to that is something like the chupacabra, which is alleged to behave in a vampire-like manner.
Now, what about cryptid cats? What are people seeing here? Animals that escape from somebody's farm, or are they really strange with red eyes?
Well, there are those reports of these giant black panthers with red eyes. Here in North America, we have a number of reports of cryptid cats, and most of those are described as large black panther-type animals. And, of course, in England, you have many that are very prevalent, such as the Beast of Exmoor, the Beast of Dartmoor, and so forth. It's interesting that people are typically describing these cats as being black, because that is very unusual.
Looks like a panther.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there are large black cats, for example, black jaguars in Central and South America, black leopards in Asia, but not native to North America or Europe.
Right.
So we do have, of course, American mountain lions and panthers here in the United States, well, pumas.
Do people, if they have petting zoos in this country, do they have to report these animals as lost if they disappear?
Well, I think that a lot of people would be hesitant to report such an incident. Obviously, you could get in a lot of trouble for something like that.
And maybe they own them illegally, so they won't even see.
Yeah. Exactly. So maybe, in fact, we could be dealing with escapes of, there are people that do collect large cats and perhaps at some point decide that they can't keep them anymore.
Are there really 20-foot crocodiles and alligators and sewer systems?
Well, I personally haven't encountered any evidence to indicate that. We have found alligators, fairly large alligators, in unusual places.
Let's talk about that when we come back, Ken. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Do not touch your dial. For less than 25 cents a day, you can become a Coast Insider, formerly Streamlink. Participate in video chats, downloads, podcasting, and just have some fun with the Coast to Coast mobile now as well when you become a Coast Insider. Simply go to coasttocoastam.com and you can sign up for a month, a year. It's up to you. Back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Ken, tell me about some of these alligator stories. Where were these creatures found?
Well, for example, there is a lake inside metropolitan Dallas area, Dallas, Texas, called White Rock Lake. And I've spoken to several eyewitnesses who encountered a very large alligator in that particular lake, which is close to a public park and so forth. The natural range of alligators does extend north into Oklahoma, but to find one in a metropolitan area like White Rock Lake is quite unusual. I know of another alligator that was discovered in a pond in Junction, Texas. Junction, Texas is actually very far west. It's essentially in the desert area of Texas here in the western part. So that is quite unusual as well. But as far as alligators in the sewers, I'm not sure if I've heard of any specific cases, although I don't doubt there could be something to those stories.
I've heard about clowns in the sewers. We don't want those either. Back to Loch Ness for a moment. In your opinion, creature there or not, what are people seeing?
Well, I think, you know, the most conservative theory, which actually holds a lot of weight, is that people are in fact seeing a gigantic eel. There are eels that are native to Loch Ness, and most of these eels will travel out to sea on occasion and then return to the lake to spawn. However, there's a theory that certain eels lose their sex drive, and they're called eunuch eels, and they simply stay on the bottom of the lake, and they just eat and eat and eat and grow to enormous sizes. Certainly an eel 15 feet long or longer is not out of the question.
And they're pretty thick as well, right?
Exactly. And, you know, they wouldn't be seen very often because they do live on the bottom of the lake. But, you know, I'm romantic, so I like to consider the notion that there could, in fact, be something like a plesiosaur.
Sure.
You know, who's to say there couldn't be? I mean, Loch Ness is such an incredibly deep lake, anywhere from 700 feet to 1,000 feet deep. The water is very dark and murky, and, you know, we just can't see what's down there. So, and we also have, you know, reports from around the world of animals that seem to resemble plesiosaurs. And there are a lot of consistencies in these different reports.
In the Loch, it's freshwater, isn't it? Or is it saltwater?
No, it's freshwater.
Freshwater, okay. Mm-hmm. But, you know, is it connected close to an ocean? How did it fill up so much?
Well, it's a glacial lake.
Okay.
It was created at the end of the Ice Age, and because it's in the mountains, you know, when the glaciers melted, left this enormous lake. It is connected to the sea. In fact, there's a river, the River Ness. There are a series of canals that connect the lake to the sea, although the, you know, it's not as quite as an open path as you would think. But it is still conceivable, I think, that we could be talking about marine visitors. Certainly, there have been accounts of sea serpents in the Earth's oceans for thousands of years. And these sea serpents, in some respect, match the descriptions of plesiosaurs and also of the Loch Ness Monster.
Would eels come ashore?
No. No, eels would not come ashore. They're strictly fish, and they you know, they can't breathe. They have gills, not lungs. So, I imagine that would sort of throw a monkey wrench in that theory.
Okay. yet people are seeing a creature on the banks of the loch, right?
Yes, absolutely. There's a very famous, there's two famous encounters from the 1930s. One involved a man named George Spicer, who, along with his wife, they were driving around the loch one night, and they actually claimed they saw the Loch Ness Monster crossing the road and then splashing into the lake. And what they described looked very much like a plesiosaur, what we would think to be a plesiosaur. Another report was made by a man named Arthur Grant, who was riding his motorcycle, and saw something very similar. And, you know, what these people described was something with a very long neck and a thick body and a long tail and four flippers, which is a very close match with a plesiosaur.
Let's take some calls here. Let's go east of the Rockies. Donald in Hollywood, Florida. Hey, Donald, go ahead.
Well, hello. How are you doing tonight?
Good. I hope you're well, too.
Yes, I am. I originally was in Pennsylvania, and I had an experience with Bigfoot, but since then I moved to Florida. I'm in Hollywood, Florida, and I work down in Miami, out in the Everglades, in mining for phosphates for cement aggregates. But anyway, I run a large drag line, which isn't probably familiar to a lot of people. You know, they don't understand what that is, but during the operation on this job, I was on a weekend with no one around, And I saw a plane coming in, a small plane, ultralight, and it was following the it was drafting the piles that I was putting up with this big equipment. And when it got close to me, it all of a sudden turned around and started flapping, and it was obviously not an ultralight.
No.
It was a large bird.
How big would you guess it might be, the wingspan?
Well, ultralight, like probably, well, you know, from, you know, I'm kind of familiar with these things. I'm thinking probably 30-foot wingspan.
That's huge.
Wow.
That is huge.
And it was like, you know, it wasn't a plane. It wasn't an ultralight. It was an animal. And I stopped everything and just watched this thing. And as it turned around, it just flapped a couple times. And like I said, it just drafted the up currents from the lake against these piles of material, which is probably like a half a mile of material. And that's what an animal would do, or a bird would do.
Did you see the head at all, Donald?
Well, actually, to tell you the truth, I just thought it was a plane. I mean, I'm in Miami, you know, and I'm out in the Everglades, so I really didn't even pay any attention to it at all until it actually came within, I'm running a large piece of equipment, like a crane.
Okay.
But it's very large, you know, and then when it got within, you know, the, like, pretty close to the top of the boom of the crane, I'm, like, concerned that the plane's going to hit my boom, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And then all of a sudden, it just makes a 180, and then it flaps, which a plane doesn't do, and then it just glides back. And I'm like, I just stopped my operation, so I'm like, whoa, what am I looking at here, you know? And I never even knew what a Thunderbird was, and when I saw that, I saw a Thunderbird. But I'm down in Miami, Florida, which is like, you know, this is kind of like a, you know, how could this be possibly, you know?
Do we get any sightings down there, Ken?
I have gotten some sightings from Florida. In fact, all over the country. So these things seem to be reported everywhere. I'm curious, do you remember if the animal you saw, could you tell if it was feathered? Or did it seem to have sort of a leathery or hide type covering? Do you remember that?
No, it definitely was a. It definitely wasn't a, like a reptile. It was definitely a feathered
a bird.
Okay. The thing is, when it came to me, I wasn't paying any attention to it. But when it turned around, you know, I had my full attention. I stopped everything, and it was a bird. You know, it was like it just. You know, this wasn't possible. And then over the time of, you know, listening to your programs and researching on the internet, I'm like, this was the Thunderbird, you know, that the Indians talk about. It's a real thing, you know.
Well, I believe the Seminole Indians of Florida did have Thunderbird legends. And, you know, as I said, I've received some reports from down there. So, yeah, that's quite fascinating, actually.
Any pictures, Ken, of these creatures?
There is a famous photograph that's almost as mysterious as the Thunderbird itself, and there's an alleged photograph that was taken in the year 1900 that purportedly shows several gentlemen stretching this giant winged Thunderbird out across the front of a barn.
I remember that picture, yeah.
Yeah, and many people have claimed to have seen it, but unfortunately no one can produce a copy of it at this point. So it's, you know, if that could be found, that would certainly be a huge piece of evidence.
I've seen it on the internet, but that doesn't mean it's so, right?
Well, there have been fakes and recreations of that particular photo, and people have attempted to reconstruct it. But to my knowledge, the original photo has not been seen, although many researchers have claimed to have owned it at one time or another, but it's simply vanished.
All right. Next up, let's go to Green River, Wyoming. Barbara, west of the Rockies. Hi, Barbara.
Hello, George.
Welcome.
Ken.
Hi.
Hi, Barbara.
Good evening, gentlemen.
Uh-huh.
George, I'd just like to tell you that I love your show, and the sound of your voice even makes everything so comforting, even when we're scared. When me and my sister and our girlfriend, we were about 15 years old, so it's been a few years ago. I'm 52 now. Mm-hmm. But we were sleeping out in the front yard, and we weren't in a tent or nothing. We were just in sleeping bags, and we were looking up at the sky and just, you know, talking like teenage girls do. And a swooping, huge bird. I believe it was like a Mothman. It had to have the wingspan of anywhere from 10, 12 feet across. And what it did is it just came out of nowhere, just swooped down on us and just took off. And, of course, you know, we ran in the house. But, you know, and then years later, the Mothman movie came out. And, of course, we're putting two and two together, and we're going, yep, that's what it, that had to have been it.
That's what it was.
Yeah, and so, you know, in Green River, we have around us are all these rock formations, and just there's just nothing out there. And our old airport is now literally on maps. It is named the Intergalactic Space Station. If you look on a map and look up Green River, Wyoming, the airport, it is literally, they changed it. They went to the city council and changed it.
I love it.
And we do see a lot of, you know, well, not we, I should say a few of us see, you know, quite a bit around here. So I just love your show. And Ken, what you're talking about is very, very interesting. I love all that kind of stuff.
All right. Thanks, Barbara.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing that.
What piece of evidence that might be out there, Ken, maybe that you have found that supports many of the things that you work on?
Well, I've recorded some vocalizations here in the state of Texas that I think are very closely related to those made by very large primates in Africa. I guess to me, that's the most convincing thing that I've personally heard or experienced, George. These, I guess the best way to describe them would be sort of like grunting or panting types of noises, but just incredibly loud, incredibly deep in tone. I mean, they literally seem to shake the surrounding brush. And I was very fortunate to have a recorder going at the time. You know, the people that I've played these recordings for are, you know, quite baffled by what they could be. Certainly they don't match anything that we know of here in North America. I guess the closest thing that they would remind me to are some of the howler monkeys that I heard down in Africa. I'm sorry, down in Central America, which have a very thunderous, booming type of quality.
Huh.
So, you know, to this day, when I play these recordings back, the little hairs on the back of my neck stand up. I'm fairly convinced that I captured something quite unusual.
You don't have it close by, do you, where we can listen to it over the phone?
Let me see what I can do.
See if you can find it at the top of the hour.
I will do that, and we'll play it over the speaker. I think that might work.
Yeah, that might. Well, what keeps you going? What keeps pushing you?
Well, I mean, you know, just the I guess a quest for knowledge and the passion for discovery. You know, like all humans, George. I mean, we strive to understand our planet and the many complexities of nature and our world around us. You know, I definitely believe that we know very little about our planet and many of the animals that inhabit it. You know, for example, you know, scientists estimate that we may have only discovered a fifth of the Earth's species.
Isn't that amazing?
Point. Yeah.
20%. That's it.
Yeah, so I mean, they're literally, you know, thousands and millions, if not millions, of animal species out there left to be discovered, and who's to say that we don't have some truly remarkable things out there that we're going to find?
They may even find that human beings went in and lived underground, and there could be a species of humans down there. Who knows? Who knows?
Absolutely.
Yep. Let's go wild card line. Dan is driving in Iowa. Hey, Dan, welcome to the show.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Hey.
I have a question for your guest, and you know, I think the evidence is mounted up to the point where we shouldn't be speculating on whether or not there is a Bigfoot or a Sasquatch. I think that there is, and I think most people would agree. But I'm wondering, when is somebody going to mount a serious expedition to try and catch one of these creatures?
They've tried, Ken, but have they been that serious? That's my question.
Well, I think it's you know, in terms of logistics, I think you're really looking at a very daunting task because the manpower and the technology and just, you know,
and the cost.
Yeah, the cost, you know, that's the thing. And it's really baffling to me because it seems like, yeah, you know, that there are some people out there that have the resources and the funds to really pursue some of these things. I think that's been a big sticking point as far as, you know, really making any progress in terms of finding these things. I mean, I think we really need to get an enormous amount of people and resources out into the field to track one down, and it just hasn't been done to this point.
How upset do you get? I won't mention any names, with those who are frauds and hucksters. Do you go nuts?
Oh, well, certainly it puts a very bad light on the field of Bigfoot research and cryptozoology when people are faking evidence. Unfortunately, I think it's unavoidable at this point. Bigfoot has become an icon in modern culture, and there unfortunately are people out there that are going to try to take advantage of that for their own notoriety or for profit or, you know, what have you.
The internet has helped. It's also hurt, hasn't it?
Oh, sure. I mean, for example, the YouTube seems to be flooded with really poor Bigfoot videos, in my opinion,
or, yeah,
you know, terrible fakes and hoaxes, and many researchers are being distracted by these and really spending way too much time looking at some of these, you know, instead of looking at some of the more solid evidence that we have at this point.
What's the mentality, Ken, with someone who fakes these things? I mean, what are they trying to do? I mean, it's, to me, it's not funny.
It's really hard to say. I personally don't understand it myself. I mean, but you know, you're always going to have people that are, you know, trying to make a quick buck. I think there's a certain gratification that some people get from perhaps trying to make other people look foolish to try to trick other people. It's sort of like, ha ha, look how clever I am. But that's a problem that runs across not only the field of cryptozoology, but also into the paranormal and UFOs and other fields of research as well.
All right, Ken, stay with us. We're going to come back for a final hour of phone calls here on Coast to Coast AM. Questions for Ken Gerhardt or your stories. Perhaps you've come across a Bigfoot or a Thunderbird, or you've been to the Loch Ness and you want to share some of those stories with us, go ahead and do that when we make the turn. Meanwhile, callers from Oak Park, Illinois, and Wichita, Kansas, and all around the map, just hang where you are so you don't lose your place in line. I'm George Norrie, and we shall be right back on Coast to Coast AM. Another hour to go with Ken Gerhardt, our special guest. And his website, of course, is tied into his Facebook account, which we've linked, and his books, Monsters of Texas and Big Bird, Modern Sightings of Flying Monsters.